because insight is one of the stages. But it is essential for insight to arise, to follow these stages that are outlined by this.
So it starts, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now, on that occasion, the venerable Kumara Kassapa, sounds like a sweet potato, doesn't he? It was a very sweet potato. Kumara Kassapa was living in the blind man's grove. And the footnote, I think, just talks about who Kumara Kassapa was. Yeah, it was an adopted son of King Pasenada of Kosala, born of a woman who, not knowing she was pregnant, had gone forth as a bhikkhuni after having conceived him. At the time this sutra was delivered, he was still a seka. Means he was still, I think seka has to do with stream entry somehow, or just practicing the virtues, I think. Somewhere around there, but close, like getting the idea. And I have to check that. He attained arahatship using this sutra as his subject of meditation. And that's probably why it's famous. And you'll find many schools that place their teaching on developing the path in this particular order. So, then, when the night was well advanced, a certain deity of beautiful appearance, who illuminated the whole of the blind man's grove, approached the venerable Kumara Kassapa and stood at one side. Another footnote. According to M.A., this deity was a non-returner living in the pure abodes. So, do you know what that means, a non-returner? So there's stream entry, first one, once returner, non-returner, and arahat. First time you experience the transcendent, it's called stream entry. That is, you've entered the stream, there's no more going back. They've broken the chains of being bound to subjection, to, you know, duality, to be being caught always. Most of the time, do you want me to try to explain a little more easy, more simply? Or is that okay?
Okay.
It's okay? Anybody more simple?
Okay,
most of the time in our lives, this our self is really in relation to an object, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And our meaning is in relation to an object. And our sense of who we should or shouldn't be is in relation to an object, right? And there are emotional ties that keep those objects running, don't they? Would you say that's true? When one object is there, then you have this emotional tie, and so you react either by ignoring it, so that's who I become. Another one, you act by agreeing with it, so that's who I become. Right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You following that?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, hi there, Miss Leslie Hansen. Oh, hello. Very nice to see you. And so most of the time, when you're, I'm just trying to describe what stream entry is, Leslie. So wish me luck. So stream entry is one of the four times you have to experience. A transcendent moment before you can be absolutely clear of being caught in conditioned responses. So most of the time in our lives, we are where there is an object, then there's a subject. If we like something, then we do it, right? I am someone who likes. If we don't like, then we don't do it, right? And we get like totally fixed in those, don't we? So then if somebody suggests trying a different pair of shoes on, we have 1,000 reasons why we can't go there, don't we? And they're always very ethical in this language. But in this language, it's like
I've never tried them on before. I don't like the looks of those, so fuck off. I'm not going to try them on.
Right? The truth is that I do not exist in relation to that object. So we just pretend it isn't there, and we move our life away, right? Then some object comes that we've already have the emotional tie to identify with. It's like, oh, I've always loved poetry. Why, when I was a child, I used to read poetry. I would memorize poetry. Don't you like poetry? And I like poetry. I don't like plastic shoes. I do like poetry. You know? So there's this I. Only the I only exists in relation to an object. You see what suffering that is? Do you see how manipulative that can make you? Do you see how easy it would be to dangle you around with the right little words, you know, democracy? Do you see that? Do you see it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand how much of our lives were caught in conditioning of a certain self? You know, I used to love the first time I took psychology as some kind of introduction to psychology. I think it was in grade 10 or grade 11 or something, because they taught us about Pavlov. Well, I fell in love with that because that just described me so well. I used to try to see if I could actually salivate when it was something I liked. Like, it just seemed right to me. Yeah? So there was that object and there was this subject who loved it. But there's something very straightforward about Pavlov, isn't there? How to condition. You teach someone when the bell rings, the food is there. Then after a while, whether the food's there or not, you ring the bell and they act like there's food there. And isn't that what we do? So when you're caught by subject-object duality, when you're blindly become the subject because the object is danced, would you call that freedom? How many of you want to hold your vote until you see what other parties are there?
No.
Thank you.
No, I'm tired of being there.
Thank you. One answer. Okay. I wouldn't call it freedom either. But when you have a choice, when you watch the desire and you have a choice about how you respond, would you call that freedom?
Yeah.
It's a little better, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just an automatically caught in duality. So the first experience, this is all lead up to trying to explain what stream entry is, an arahat. The first experience of a moment that is absolutely transcendent of duality, subject-object duality, transcends any other way that the consciousness has manifested. And it is profound and it's brilliant. And it cuts out any kind of view of a fixed self. Immediately there is knowledge. Of there is not a fixed self. There are these different Pavlovian responses. And there is choice. That as soon as you understand the beauty of impermanence of a fixed identity and realize that that's true, the joy of choice is profound. But if you try to maintain something that is impermanent, that's not a lot of fun. Remember all those funky old murder mysteries there used to be, and they used to film them where the person was living in this really rich house and then they were murdered one day and the detectives come in. This was an often used plot, and I used to love murder mystery movies. And you go break in, and actually the house was very poor and the person would be eating crumbs in the kitchen or something, that kind of thing. And there's a quality of that, you know, about when we're always trying to maintain an appearance, isn't there?
Mm.
And when we keep trying to maintain whatever the appearance is, rather than celebrating the present moment, whatever it is, if it's death, it's death. If it's life, it's life. If it's old age, it's old age. If it's sickness, it's sickness. The thing is that it is like a possibility to open the heart and the mind, isn't it? And so when you take life itself as the blessing, regardless, you know, of whether you prefer the odor of the roses to the thorn, you know, that's not the point. The point is that you can choose whether you prefer the rose or the thorn. You can choose to see the possibility of both. Don't blind yourself to one because you're grasping after the other. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're not caught in that kind of grasping and dissatisfactoriness, immediately, then the sense of no inherent identity arises. Suddenly that's struck from your, it's so strong, it's such a relief, it's so joyful, you never go back. So that's called stream entry. There are 10, you know, my old friend Jim Bell, Kamananda, used to call them fretters. There are 10 fretters, you know, fetters. And when he first did it, it was because he actually didn't miss it. You know, he wasn't that good at reading. He actually didn't actually read it, right? But after a while, it was like so true that, you know. So anybody who ever studied with Jim or with Kamananda, they tend to say fretter quite often. It's quite lovely. There are 10 fretters that have to fall before liberation is of being caught in subject-object duality is completed. So those are called the 4 stages of enlightenment. Right? Stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and ara. So this guy, according to this deity, was a non-returner. And now you know what that means. So that means you no longer have to be reborn in a womb. You could be, but you're not subject to it. Living in the pure abodes, he and Kumara Kassapa had been, I'm reading a footnote in case you can't find it. Does that feel better? Well, a couple of people with the pages were looking for it too. He and Kumara Kassapa had been members of a group of 5 fellow monks in the dispensation of the previous Buddha Kashyapa. Because you know that Shakyamuni Buddha was only one of how many? He's the 6th one, wasn't he? Of this dispensation, of this Kalpa. And there's supposed to be 1,000 every Kalpa, more or less, but who's counting? So, you know, there's more Buddhas than you can shake sticks at. But there is a long time between Buddhas. So Shakyamuni was, I think, the 7th. Did I say Kashyapa was the 6th or 7th?
6th.
Yeah, and I think Shakyamuni, the Buddha, was the 7th Buddha. And the 8th is already got a name and is apparently cooking in one of the higher realms and will be ripe soon. A few more thousand years will reappear. Okay? Has been member of the following, who in the dispensation of the previous Buddha Kassapa had practiced meditation with this guy that he's appearing in front of, together on a mountaintop. So that's a little bit of his history, right? So we have this man sitting there meditating, and in the middle of the night this deity appears. That's the 2nd paragraph of 23, right? The deity appears, approached the venerable Kumara Kassapa, stood at one side. So standing, the deity said to him, the 2nd paragraph of 23, sorry. Mm-hmm. Got it? So now we're going to number 2. So this is the deity is basically going to pose a riddle to Kumara Kassapa. It's going to just pose a riddle, and it's a very long riddle. So if this next part doesn't make sense, just understand this is until you get to the next page a bit. Until you get to the next page, this is all the riddle. So here's the riddle. This is what this deity, who's actually a third stage enlightened being. Bhikkhu, bhikkhu, this anthill fumes by night and flames by day. Thus spoke the Brahman. So he's a pain. This is all part of the. This isn't. The Brahman is not either one of the two characters. Mm. The first few times I read this, I had to keep reminding myself of that. So hopefully, this is useful to you. Mm-hmm. The Brahman is. This is all part of the riddle. So somebody comes to this bhikkhu and says, "Bhikkhu, bhikkhu, this anthill fumes by night and flames by day." And thus spoke the Brahman, or the great understander, the teacher. And delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a bar. A bar, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Throw out the bar. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a toad. A toad, venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Throw out the toad. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a fork. A fork, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Throw out the fork. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a sieve. A sieve, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Throw out the sieve. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a tortoise. A tortoise, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman, throw out the tortoise, delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw an axe and a block. An axe and a block, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman, throw out the axe and block, delve with the knife, thou wise one. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a piece of meat. A piece of meat, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Wait a minute. Throw out the piece of meat. Delve with the knife, thou wise man. Delving with the knife, the wise one saw a naga serpent. A naga serpent, O venerable sir. Thus spoke the Brahman. Leave the naga serpent. Do not harm the naga serpent. Honor the naga serpent. And then the angel, the deity, said to the bhikkhu, to Kumara Kashyapa, Bhikkhu, you should go to the Blessed One and ask him about this riddle. Because otherwise he might think he was just having a bad meditation session. You just never know. It was kind of him to tell him that, I think. As the Blessed One tells you, so should you remember it. Bhikkhu, other than the Tathagata, or a disciple of the Tathagata thus gone, or one who has learned it from them, I see no one in this world with its gods, its maras, its brahmins, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, whose explanation of this riddle might satisfy the mind. That is what was said by the deity, who thereupon vanished at once. Then, when the night was over, the venerable Kumara Kashyapa went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what had occurred. Then he asked, Venerable Sir, what is the anthill? What is the fuming by night and the flaming by day? Who is the Brahman? Who is the wise one? What is the knife? What is delving? What the bar? What is the toad, the fork, the sieve? What's the tortoise? What is the axe and block? What about the piece of meat? And what is the naga serpent? Bhikkhu, the anthill, is a symbol for this body, made of material form, consisting of the four great elements, procreated by a mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and porridge. the footnote talks about a special kind of like sort of soured milk and stuff thing that was eaten a lot for breakfast that it went rotten in a day, so it had special application here. Built up out of boiled rice and porridge and subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration. It's the anthill, it's the body. Built up of all these different things, you keep feeding it, but it slowly wears and rubs away. Hey? What one thinks and ponders by night, based upon one's actions during the day, is fuming by night. The actions one undertakes during the day by body, speech, and mind, after thinking and pondering by night, is called flaming by day. That's about it, isn't it? Fuming by night and flaming by day. Yeah, don't see that too often in the supermarket. The Brahman is a symbol for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The wise one is a symbol for a bhikkhu in higher training, a monk who is open to higher training. Not just to be a little more comfortable in duality, like I am or you are, but together we make a bhikkhu, because enough times one of us will have the spark of wishing for more than just being comfortable, that we catch each other on fire. You know, it's called sangha, it's called community. We keep each other honest, right? Don't we?
Yeah.
You better keep me honest, yeah. I'll take my teeth out. He's so unimpressed with this. With my performance. He likes the Dharma, not the performance. The wise one is a symbol for a bhikkhu in higher training. The knife is a symbol for noble wisdom. The delving is a symbol for the arousing of energy. Higher wisdom means the clarity of seeing things as they are. Not being like seeing something and seeing the emotional attachment and seeing the choice. So that cuts through, you see? So it's a knife. Beautiful, huh? Mm-hmm. The delving is a symbol for arousing energy. Because you might see all that and then you might not have the energy to make a choice. Throw out the bar means, no, the bar is a symbol for ignorance. So that he's talked about, you know, the anthill, and now he's talking about what the guy finds when he's delving. The bar is a symbol for ignorance. That's what bars us, ignoring. Isn't it? Ignoring is what bars us. I don't think there's anything more important to learn than that. I guess the most important thing to do, because we use ignorance for our convenience, don't we? And therefore we rob ourselves of the opportunity to be more open, more enlightened, more willing, more a symbol of what really is. Isn't that true? But it's so simple. And we just got it slide over it. Slide.
Oh, I didn't see that. Sorry.
Throw out the bar, abandon ignorance. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. This is the meaning. The toad is a symbol for despair due to anger. Throw out the toad. Abandon despair due to anger. Because you know when you have a great rage of anger, then you're exhausted. Oh, why did I bother? Oh, you know that? How wonderful it is. Throw out the toad. Don't go there. Delve with the knife. Bow wise man. It didn't say kill it. Notice it didn't say any of them kill. Just like move it out of the way. Move it out of the way. Don't engage. Just move it out of the way. The fork is a symbol for doubt. Skeptical doubt, you know, where like you would like to believe something, but you don't want to. You know that one? Mm-hmm. So it's like two-pronged. Mm-hmm. Our English word ambivalence suits it exactly. Ambivalent. Mm-hmm. Wanting to veil in two ways. Throw out the fork, abandon doubt, delve with the knife, thou wise man. That is the meaning. The sieve is a symbol for the five hindrances. They don't let things run freely, right? Now the first one, desire for an experience other than that which is present. Mm-hmm. Sensual desire. Throw out the fork. Namely, the hindrance of sensual desire, hindrance of ill will, followed quickly by anger because somebody else got it, or just this feeling of dissatisfaction because you got it but it wasn't as good as it could have been, or it didn't last, or somebody interfered with you, or you're finally in the bathroom and the phone rings, or you know? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Anger. So these are all the things that stop just the free flowing of energy. Hindrance of sloth and torpor. There are many translations of that. That sense of, oh, well, what's the point anyway? You know, if they really care, they'll phone back. It probably wasn't the person I was waiting for. My favorite. It wasn't meant to be. The hindrance of restlessness and remorse. Oh, maybe. I'm going out then. I'm going for. I'm gonna go gamble. I'm gonna get drunk. No. If only I had been there. I mean, if I. But the mind going past and future, and the body going past and future. Mm. They're all familiar, aren't they, to all of us? So this is Buddhism. It's like common sense. But it's more like a common sense mirror that allows you to see how you're not letting yourself just enjoy your life and find out what you're really capable of. What you're really capable of, or what I'm really capable of. You know what I'm saying? It's just like very, mm-hmm. This is our work, not somebody else's. And then the hindrance of doubt, which is finally, well, it wouldn't work anyway. Well, I didn't want to talk to them anyway. You know that one? Well, I didn't want to go anyway. I remember one of my favorite examples of that, because it was so strong, it actually shocked me, even though I was stoned out of my brain. It was at a party in 1963, I think. There's this guy named Alan Watts. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Mm-hmm. He shared half a houseboat with this guy named Varda, who was an artist in Sausalito and just outside of San Francisco. And they used to have great parties. I was often at those parties, and everybody was always, you know, interacting with each other. Various and sundry fashions at these parties. And there was always new people coming and going. It was like sort of one of the off the society page places to be. You know, if you were invited, that meant you were in the proper non-societal society. And this was, you know, when, if you remember, that was when I used to sell poetry on the streets for food and things. And so this guy is like chatting me up. And he says, "So, what do you do, little girl?" And that sort of kind of, you know, that kind of little thing. Well, he didn't say little girl, but you understand what I'm doing. And I said,
"I write poetry."
And he said, "Oh, yes, I used to write poetry too." But there was this quality about him saying it, that it was such a wall. That it, you know, probably I didn't even understand the words because I used to be so stoned all the time. But the emotion was profound. It was like, oh yeah, wall against that. You'll grow out of it, kid. You know? It's like that. It's kind of like, and it remains to this day, as you can tell, my strongest experience, not only from myself, but from other people, of putting a wall there and just saying, oh yeah, well, doesn't work. And there's something about that, using the intellect to have a reason to cover your fear and your desire, you know? That's very interesting, isn't it? Skeptical doubt, they call it. So, those are the five hindrances. And you can see how they actually do start slowing down the streaming of your energy. I mean, the energies can still run through I used to write poetry, but it's going to be most of the time kind of on a piece of paper or Kleenex that gets thrown in the garbage, isn't it? You're not, like, just being willing to see whether you still write poetry or you might write poetry, you know? There isn't that openness. Who are I? I don't know who I are. It could be anybody, you know? True? The choice is closed. So that's like, we can just as much stick ourselves in a subject-object by denial as we can by affirmation. And neither one of them are particularly comfy. So those are the five hindrances, which is the sieve. The tortoise is a symbol for the five aggregates affected by clinging. So the five aggregates, you know that if you were going to, in Buddhism, very common, all the schools of Buddhism, every school talks about the five aggregates. If you were going to talk about mind-body, how consciousness in form manifests, you could divide it into five categories, or, you know, aggregates is very similar. The word in Pali, which is supposedly is closest to the original, and the Buddha Shakyamuni gave his teaching on the five aggregates. Aggregates actually means heaps. And there's sort of five separate heaps, but they kind of run together. You can't take one away. If there's one, there's all five. And he has compared it in various sutras to, like, light coming through a prism. The light splits into a rainbow, but you can't separate any of the colors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, there is no way. Where one aggregate is, all five are. So it's in that kind of framework that you understand the aggregates. But you can understand that they're like five fingers, and they each have a different function, right? And depending on which country, the function changes. Yeah, it's really nice to learn the hand language before you start using it when you travel around the world. Because you never know what you're actually going to be saying. So the five aggregates are form. So it says, the tortoise is a symbol for the five aggregates affected by clinging. Namely, the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging. Usually it's mental formations. And the consciousness affected by clinging. throw out. So it isn't saying that the aggregates themselves, is saying when they're affected by clinging. Self-grasping. Right? Throw out the tortoise. Abandon the five aggregates affected by clinging. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. That is the meaning. The axe and block is a symbol for the five cords of sensual pleasure. Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. Throw out the axe and block, abandon the five cords of sensual pleasure, delve with the knife, thou wise one. This is the meaning. So you got the axe and the block here. So you got the block is basically here. They've got the axe and the block. In Vajrayana, they usually talk about an inner deity and an outer deity. The deity of the eye would be a particular one that often is this little gorgioso little, you know, hot tomato dakini who's carrying a mirror to represent perception. And the one out here, and this one is colored, usually white, to cognize form, so it's usually white. And the one out here is black, meaning it could be anything. So you got the axe and the block in this language. In the Theravada, the axe and the block. In the Vajrayana, they talk about a colored one and a black one. That could be any color. Black contains all the colors, right? Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying which vibration it works on, because each of the colors is a different vibration. So this is talking about each of the five sense doors are like an axe that cut for a particular type of wood. This one's good for kindling, this one's good, you know, for a particular, this is for hearing, this is for, and a block, which can be anything. And clinging to them, thinking that you hate this sound or you love this sound, rather than watching the process of sound, watching the process of sight. Where do you actually see? Are you looking at me, or are you bringing light into your eyes and watching your brain form an image of me? It is not my fault, it's your brain. Okay, that wasn't funny.
Okay. Is there a reason why he's only describing them as desirable? As opposed to undesirable or not like?
Provocative of lust. Well, sensual desire, like, you know, some people are so fascinated by a fire that they set fires.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your ear is really tuned to hear an unusual sound. Can you hear that lamp?
Mm.
Hear that lamp?
Mm.
Was it harder to hear it a minute ago?
Mm-hmm.
Is that lamp about to explode? And the lamp gets louder and louder, doesn't it? When there's like this...
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, it's just lighting the room, and it's actually not the lamp at all. It's the heater on the other side of the hall there. You can hear it through the wall. And the lamp, the sound goes down a little bit. Oh, is it warm in here? Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most of this is like just if you actually try it in the most literal way in your own being, mm-hmm. you probably find, oh, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, eh?
Yeah, thank you.
The piece of meat is a symbol for delight and lust. Throw out the piece of meat, abandon, delight, and lust. Delve with the knife, thou wise one. This is the meaning. The Naga serpent is a symbol for a bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints. Now, what do they mean by taints here? I don't remember. 284. This is an arahat. Note 75. An arahat, the fourth stage, right? The word Naga is a class of dragon-like beings in Indian mythology believed to inhabit the nether regions of the earth and be the guardians of hidden treasures, sort of like dragons. The word comes to represent any gigantic or powerful creature, such as a tusk or elephant or a cobra, and by extension an arahant bhikkhu. So somebody who has experienced the four stages of liberation would be considered to be a Naga. Powerful energy is the idea behind it. Powerful energy. That is what the Blessed One said. Did I finish that? Leave the Naga serpent. Do not harm the Naga serpent. Honor the Naga serpent. This is the meaning. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Kumara Kashyapa was satisfied and delighted. And good as words. It's a short one, huh? That's it. So if you look at that, going back to that this body, and looking at how becoming the first one with the body as the anthill fuming by night and flaring by day, how we are caught in becoming, right? So then the second one, the knife is to question how, whether there is anything other than chasing after becoming, desire for an experience other than that which is just present, desire to be away from an unpleasant experience, or the desire for a pleasant experience to last forever. You know, those three becomings that chase us. Whether there is any other thing. And so then with the instruction, those are the first three parts, and then comes the bar. So to be able to throw out the bar of ignorance, it's required that you know what ignorance is. So that means the development of awareness. But before there can be the development of awareness, there needs to be a mind that is not always checking on everything, doesn't there? So if you have a lot of doubt about whether you're sitting in the right place or somebody else is doing something, then in Buddhism they say you need to develop power, that is to say, you need to develop merit. You need to develop a sense of confidence because you know you're good. You need to practice the good so that you have the power to ask a question. Do you ever have somebody ask you a question by saying, I suppose this is a foolish question, but how does it make you feel? How does it make you feel? If they're really like hamming that one up big time, how does it make you feel? I hate to bother you with this, but does it? It's interesting though, isn't it? You know, there are people who they ask questions almost like they're luring you into this dark place. You know the feeling? You know that feeling? You don't know that feeling, Ruth? I have a couple of friends I'll introduce you to. Mm-hmm. because there is a sense that somehow or other they're bothering you, or they should know already. Do you ever find people that when they ask a question, they feel like they should know it already?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing I'm talking about. Say, why should you know already what you don't know already? Does it make sense? Why should you? So it's like a lack of confidence. So what do you do to a lack of confidence? You be seen to do good, but not by others, by yourself. Good, not right. There's a wee huge difference between right and good. Isn't there? Good is very simple. Right usually has a banner flying. People who aren't very confident love joining parades and being right, don't they? But good is quite different, isn't it? Good is just this very simple openness. Because there's nothing you're missing. If there's nothing you're missing, you feel good, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to confuse those two. Unless you turn around and really, you know, just real simplicity, just say, you know, okay, I feel like something's missing, is that why I want to go march or warn everybody about the end of the world or whatever, you know? But good, it's easy if somebody comes, it's easy if nobody comes. Because there's that kind of confidence, isn't there? The times that you feel good. It's like, it's so sweet and so beautiful, very, very direct. So having established good, then you can start watching for ignorance. Watching for when you ignore, because if you start watching for ignorance, willful or unwillful ignorance, without a sense of good, what you're going to do? You're going to try to correct yourself all the time. You're going to try to polish the brick, aren't you? Polish like mad, aren't you? Make sure that did I say that? I didn't really mean that. I meant this. Oh, no, yeah. Well, you know what I mean. Right? Continuously polishing the brick. It's a brick! It's a brick! So like, whereas if you feel good, when you see ignorance, you can just be interested. Oh, that was ignoring. Huh. Oh, that's neat. Oh, and there's here real interest in this, so I don't want to look at that. That's a kind of ignoring. You go, So you actually start to understand it, rather than try to perform something that you don't know anyway, because you don't believe you could be capable of it. It's different, isn't it? So it always starts with the good. But the good is to develop the power of confidence. If you don't have confidence, you can't possibly look at yourself. And if you don't have confidence, the only person who's in charge of that is you. Nobody else can give you confidence, can they? You're the one who has to decide, well, I'm here. I used to give that meditation, walking meditation, to people quite often. I've only given it once in the last couple of months, so either I've forgotten it or I am here. Put one foot down. I am here. The other foot, I have the right to be here. Walking, I am here. Right to be here. You know, and some people, they start off real angry and then they end up, it's a question. I am here. I have the right to be here. Where are we? But some people, it's like they suddenly say, well, maybe I do. Well, maybe it's okay to be here. Rather than the hamster on the treadmill. So having established confidence, then by feeling good, by being the good, then ignorance, despair, because despair is not going to come up the same way, is it? When you see the ignorance, you're not going to fall for the reason why you're despairing it. You're just going to be watching that if you have that power. See how all of them depend on having that ground, that stable ground of power. The fork is for doubt rather than question and the ability to try. Should I or shouldn't I? How can I change without changing? That's all I want to know. Could you just fill that in, please? Do you teach how to change without changing? No, but I will continue teaching what I do teach. And if you find somebody who teaches how to change without changing, let me know. I'd sign up. The five hindrances, so that you're not like losing the energy of your real desire. By those five, sieving, then actually watching what is form, what is feeling, then they can have real insight into those things. So when you have real insight into those things, then the next thing that happens is, well, what is reality? How do I know that when I think I'm seeing Leslie, I'm actually seeing Leslie? I don't know that. Is there an I?
Is there a lesson?
That was my, is there a lesson? Or well, is there an I? Mm-hmm. What is hearing? How does a cat hear different than I do? How does a dog? What about a grasshopper? What about a bird? What is the right word? Which brings you very quickly into David Bohm, reality is the thing we think about. What is thought? What is perception? What is mind? What is mind? But you get there, you see, by practicing feeling good. If you don't start there, you can never get there. Five cores of sensual pleasure, piece of meat, symbol for delight and lust. That's like always, you know, thinking that you've gotten somewhere or clinging to. I know it might be hard for you to believe, but there are people who, when they have meditation experiences of what they call jhana, which are extremely blissful experiences that become so refined that, you know, they're beyond even they're not in the, like as orgasm, sexual orgasm is considered very crude and disruptive in compared to the high of some of these blisses. That there are people who have those experiences and they can last for hours, you know, that they never want to leave them. That's hard to believe, I know, but it's true. There are people who really, you know, the more refined and clear the consciousness comes, the more they identify that as self. Mm-hmm. Of course, none of you would ever do that, I understand, nor me, except on every other day. But that lust and desire and lust can be for very subtle things, can't they? And some of us think we're being subtle, but we're not being subtle at all. Isn't that true? Because, you know, we want it to go this way and we're driving. And probably one, for me, the most difficult desire or lust to give up, which I continuously struggle with, is meaning. Mm-hmm. I like there to be a meaning. Anything except this is it. So I can do my... So it can be very subtle, that desire and lust, and it's actually the last one. And then once you have been able to see those as not self, not be the subject to that object, the objects of these, then the last one is the Naga serpent, which represents just great energy. It's the profound coming into being and passing away of every moment. Leave it alone. Consciousness which has no legs rides winds which have no eyes. So that's that sutra. Quite interesting, isn't it, for such a short one? And that only took us an hour, and we don't have copies of the next one, so do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Actually, we do have copies of the next one.
Do we? Where are they? Mm-hmm.
Attached to the back of these ones.
Oh. Oh, you do. So shall we start the next one? Or let's see if you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints. How long have we been teaching this?
4 years.
4 years. We've been working from the introduction, and we've got to 23. 24. We've done 24. Have we done 24? We've done 23. We're going to start 24. 4 years. That makes what? 5 a year, basically? No.
6.
Almost 6 a year. But this year isn't over. We might...
get to 30.
And then a couple of times I was gone for 6 months.
Yeah,
so that takes off a year right there. That's like 12 a year we've been doing. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
In a monastery, how would they study these? Would they take years and years to do?
They study them, first of all, by chanting them together, and then they learn them individually, and then they meditate on them. This was the book that I used to meditate on when I was in Thailand. Not this particular copy, but this, the Majjhimani, the middle length saying. Because the monastery I was staying at had a good English library. And that was very classical. I didn't know it at the time, but after I'd been doing it for a while, somebody asked me who had instructed me in such a classical way.
So you would spend
a sutra, I would meditate, go back and read it again, I'd meditate, I sometimes take one paragraph and meditate, walk with it. Wash my robes, say hello to the bhikkhu dog, walk, watch out for the mad rooster, walk.
What color were your robes?
White. That's what color now in Thailand they do have nuns, but then they didn't, they had what they called mechi, which it means, it's translated as nun, but it isn't actually nun, because nun is bhikshuni. You have basically the eight precept ordination. You take the eight precepts, which is sort of like the earliest. First is the five precepts, which is lay people. Take the five precepts, and then eight precepts, and then so forth, it goes up. So that's what they used to have, that only when I was in Thailand, because that was a long time ago. But now there are monasteries in Thailand that are dedicated to nuns, and they're actually bhikshunis. They're actually getting full ordination, which in, when I was there was never possible. It's pretty nice. You go to Korea or Taiwan to get full ordination. Those are the only places that women could still be ordained. Now, even the Tibetans are doing full ordination for nuns and giving them the full education. Well, that's very recent, you know, that's not long term. That's in my lifetime, eh? Damn, we're getting old. So, was that all right? Any other?
And I just wondered how long, you know, this would be like
a
lifetime's kind of study?
It would depend on the person.
Mm.
And it would depend on the familiarity, you know. I mean, there are people, you know, who one meets that they seem to already know the sutras. And when they read them, it's like almost reading something they'd forgotten where they put it. And, oh, here it is again, this letter. Remember this one?
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, it's like joyful meeting of an old friend. And for some people, it's like, what did I just read? Oh, did we just do something about a platypus or something? Oh, no, it was a toad. No, oh, the ants. Was it the ant sutra? No, no. What about an ant? Ant hill! No, that's what fumes by night and fumes by day. No, wait, you know. So it depends. I mean, you would have regular chanting of them. And the people who, you know, the people who got really good at chanting them, like you would learn them by rote. And one of the signs of somebody who would get a particular name, Acharya, meaning well-learned one who carries the teaching, would be that if they could quote, you know, if they could run non-stop through, say, 50 of these or 100 of these, there's 152 different teachings in this volume. If someone could chant the whole thing, then they would be considered, you know, they're allowed like maybe one or two mistakes with a word like and or yet could be misplaced or something, but in all this whole book. And so because it was not a written tradition for a very long time, and they maintained the oral tradition, and sometimes what they do is they have monks usually who have been raised only in the oral tradition, and they come together with monks who have been trained in the written tradition, and the monks with the written tradition check while the oral tradition chant, just to test them to see how good they are. They've been doing that, you know, off and on for many years. It's interesting, eh?
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different way of... Because we tend to look at rote as something poo-poo, you know?
Yeah.
How boring. But we don't think that about how we go with rote over the same thoughts in our mind over and over again. We think that's damn exciting. And moi. I think, therefore, I am thinking, I am, therefore, I think, I am. Is that good?
That's good.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? You've had a lot of teachers and a lot of different stuff and a lot of activity. Do you want to quit early tonight, or do you do, Ruth?
Yeah.
You want to keep going? So I'm asking you. Shall we start the next sutra or shall we leave it? There's like 20 minutes left.
Let's leave it.
Okay, that's one vote for quitting, one vote for reading. Here we go. Next. It's a tie so far. Come on. What's your vote?
Let's continue.
Continue. Come on, we need another quit.
I was going to say quit.
Quit.
Well, I'll go along.
With what? Which one?
One in between her.
Which one, Otto? Continue? Quit?
Well, always interested, but I know that there's so much which is good to absorb, and that's okay.
So is that quit?
Yeah.
Okay, quit. This is quit, this is continue.
Quit.
Back row? Have I heard everybody in the front rows?
Yeah.
In back row? How about you? Quit.
I would hurt so well, quit.
Oh, you voted already. So, that's it. And so we will continue, but we'll do that. I'm not sure if you wanted me to come up next month or not. I could possibly come up at the end of the month. I don't know how busy you are. Because Boise people have me for 3 weeks, not the whole month. So we can talk about that when I talk to my scheduling people, but either next month or the month after, we'll start at 24th. And my trip to Boise has been cut down to 3 weeks, so I got more time to dig up the melodies if the ground isn't frozen. I want that. Yeah, thank you. That's how I keep track of us. So you notice this beautiful gold light in your heart bones, which is just sort of where your ribs divide, but in front of your spine, about an inch. There's this nice little space there. It's a very tiny room, circular. Lots of light and warmth, like an inner little tiny perfect fireplace. And it's just gleaming there. Somewhere around dinner. It's right about there. The light just shines through your whole body, up to your shoulders, and down to your hips. And it goes dipping down your legs and into your toes. You can wiggle them and feel it. Down your arms, up your head, relaxes your neck, out your ears. Moves out from your body, fills this room. Anybody you're thinking of that you want to wish health or joy, just imagine this light just washes through the whole city. The whole province. Just moves out into space. And I think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is this. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is this. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is this.
So thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.